music and talk radio about all things, all genders. This is Intravenous, live on CJSF 90.1 FM, discussing and approaching contemporary gender issues through a feminist lens. Our goal is to educate, engage, and challenge the dominant hegemony.
Hello, you are listening to Intravenous on CJSF 90.1 FM. My name is Ksenia. Today I will be playing an interview that I did with Nino Kane, the Executive Director of Ending Violence Association of BC. We will be revisiting a case that occurred back in 2018 in London, Ontario, of Canada. And in 2025 of May, it was revealed that the case that involved five hockey players who were found not guilty of sexually assaulting a young woman. And in this interview, we'll just be discussing about consent, the concept of it, and how the legal authority approached it, what needs to change in the criminal justice system, and what type of education is needed to prevent things like this so victims can get actual justice.
My name is Ninu Kang. I'm the Executive Director of Ending Violence Association of BC, and we're a provincial organization that supports over 300 programs in our province that respond directly to survivors, supporting survivors of gender-based violence. My interest in this particular case, the outcome and the whole proceedings of the five professional junior hockey team who were charged and subsequently acquitted. My interest is that we are supporting survivors of gender-based violence, our members, and you know, for years, survivors have told us that the criminal justice system is not a place where they feel like they get justice. And even those individuals that go through the justice system and there is a conviction, often the sentencing is not, you know, representative of the crime that these individuals have committed. So we've been following this trial and the outcome of this trial closely, and I'd like to speak to, you know, what we have seen publicly and what education needs to happen and what supports need to be in place for survivors to have a responsive justice system where survivors will feel like they have received justice when they've experienced sexual violence.
Yeah, the criminal code definitely like defines consent as like voluntary agreement, free from coercion. And based on these facts emerging from the Hockey Canada trial, where do you see the main disconnect between the legal definition of and how consent is understood or argued in court?
Yeah, I mean, the legal definition of consent, which is what the justice system really takes into account, of course, is a definition that really ensures that those who have been convicted of sexual violence, or those who are accused, I should say, accused of sexual violence, that, you know, they also receive a fair trial. And what the definition, I think, doesn't address the nuances of what a survivor of a sexual violence experiences, and you know, when there is a relationship of power imbalance, that does an individual truly able to withdraw consent at any time in that relationship, in that situation? And if there is such power imbalance within that relationship, and an individual is in many cases is under the influence of alcohol or other forms of drug, can they really give consent? And I think what this trial and the process of this trial also points to is the criminal justice system's lack of understanding of how a survivor who've experienced trauma during this incident, what happens to memory, for example, as a result of experiencing trauma, that memory is impaired, memory is not linear, and therefore when an individual is, remembering events or giving testimony or even speaking to the police about it, they may not appear to be so coherent, and they may not appear to remember all the events in sort of, you know, such neat fashion that I think many of our justice system would prefer, that it's linear, it's consistent. And I think this case really points to that the experience of trauma isn't the nuances that the criminal justice system takes into place of survivors that experience the trauma of sexual violence.
And in this case, the complainant describes being asked to record a video stating she consented. How should court assess post-event statements like this when coercion may be present?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the question really the courts need to also ask themselves is how valid and what is the motivation behind such recording? You know, if an individual feels like they need to record whether consent was given, should the courts be questioning why such video was even, you know, the need for such video to be created? And I think it's those nuances that the court misses, because obviously there, I think from what we as advocates have heard from survivors over and over and over again, is that there's coercion and control in those relationships. And so even if an individual has clearly been assaulted, and, you know, can they really say no if someone is asking for a recording to confirm that they have not been assaulted, mm-hmm. right? It's that power imbalance that exists in those relationships and the relationships. So I think that's the critique that, you know, while there are, you know, many varying opinions on the outcome of this trial, I think what advocates who have worked with survivors and who many of them themselves are survivors, what they're saying is, look, the courts need to take into account the complexity of coercion and control in these relationships. And so the recording from, of course, many survivors' experiences, of course, there was a recording that was asked for because it was clear that within that relationship there was coercion and control. And obviously the survivor didn't feel like they could say, like, no, what happened to me was wrong. And so therefore it was recorded that consent was given, when in fact, from probably anyone that's listening to this radio, you know, should be asking themselves that question, like, can a person really say no in that situation?
Yeah. And with the power imbalance, such as fame, status, or group pressure, how does this, like, you know, does this complicate the concept of voluntary consent, since the guys were let off? And I'm assuming because they were, like, such famous hockey players?
Well, I think what we're left with is a couple of questions. One is, what is the message that is given to anyone that experiences such type of violence? Someone that becomes a survivor of such incident, or maybe not even such so dramatic, because, you know, this was clearly a number of individuals, which is on the public record, that engaged in sexual activities with one individual. So, like, but even if you're looking at, you know, where there is sexual violence between one individual to another, I think the question is, what's the message this is giving to survivors? Which is that, look, even if you go into the public sphere to seek justice, this is how you're going to be scrutinized. When we saw the, you know, when we heard the defense lawyers, five defense lawyers, you know, question EM, which is the name that that we are using, of course, for the survivor in this case, and to be scrutinized for hours and hours by five different defense lawyers, it's given a very clear message, I think, to survivors: is, look, it's just, you make a choice. You know, it's probably best for you to stay quiet and shut up and don't go public about this, because this is how you're going to be treated. I think that's one message. What's the message this is giving to men and young boys? Well, the message this, to me, this, what this is also giving is, look, you can get away with it.
Yeah.
Like, you can get away with it. And so, again, I think, you know, this is professional hockey players. And again, you know, I give sort of due respect to the process, and the outcome is what it is. I think what we're questioning is that there's a moral, you know, morality to this, where there's a group of individuals who have clearly, an individual has felt violated by a group of individuals, sexually assaulted. And I think the question for all of us is this morally correct? Is this morally acceptable in our society, that when clearly there have been evidence that a group of individuals have assaulted a woman, a group mm-hmm. of boys assaulted a 20-year-old woman, is that morally a right thing? Is that a correct thing for us to take forward? And so message to boys. And I guess the other thing that I'd like to share is that perhaps this is being talked about less, but I think equally important, which is that why did not any one of those young men intervene and stop and said, hey, like, hey guys, buddies, this is wrong. Like, this is not cool. Like, mm-hmm. let's cut this out. Let's walk. And so, you know, there is a question, the level of pressure young men feel as a result of what they think that men and boys should do when they have access to, you know, free sex, for a lack of better language, with a woman. Like, you know, did those young boys, and I'm not going to use the word consent there, but were they willing participants, or was the societal pressure as young men to think that this is the thing to do so much that when these individuals are probably making very good decisions in their life anywhere else, when it comes to this, they completely failed in terms of a decision that they made. And so there is that question, I think, about what are young men still learning? What are young men still learning about exploitation of women, and that women's bodies are to be exploited and to be used? Mm-hmm. Like, one would think in today's day and age that we're so far past that, and yet here it is. And I think that's also a very noteworthy conversation for us to continue having, is, you know, what is happening in our societal morality, societal norms, that is continue to teach men, young men, boys, young men, older men as well, that this can still happen in our society? Mm-hmm. And so I think this is a disturbing trend. And so, again, I think the courts may have legally done what they were supposed to do, but I think that what's become clear is that the courts don't have the level of sensitivity and understanding of trauma that survivors of sexual violence needs to get justice.
Yeah. And what specific changes could be made to the jury instructions or prosecutorial approaches to account for these dynamics?
Well, I think some people argue that perhaps a jury in this case would have been better, that maybe, you know, peer opinions, would they have been better? I don't know. It's hard. I'm sure people, it's hard to say whether a jury would be better, because I think, you know, some folks have critiqued the justice in not really sort of understanding what EM's experience of trauma was. So I think there is a little bit of that conversation out there as well, for sure. What changes? I think training and education, for sure. And I think, you know, when you sort of look at the bigger cover-up of this story, I think that's also something that hasn't really been taken into consideration. I think, you know, when EM first came to the police, charges weren't laid, she wasn't believed, and it wasn't until public pressure that, you know, the charges were finally laid and then sort of process unfolded. You know, I think more training and education in the whole justice system, right from police onwards. And I think, you know, just more public education, just more public knowledge and public pressure of the fact that, you know, whether it's, you know, young women who are experiencing disproportionate amount of sexual violence from kind of that age of, you know, when they're at university age, that these young women and even, you know, non-binary folks are experiencing disproportionate amount of sexual violence. And you folks, you know, at the universities, I mean, this is a high risk for young women and non-binary folks that are coming into universities. When you look at stats and data. And I think equally, parents and friends of young men should also be worried. Mm-hmm. They should also be worried that, you know, are their young boys and their young, you know, sons and brothers and brothers who are going into universities, are they going to find themselves in situations where, you know, they're not going to use good judgment, and their you know, predominant thinking about what it means to be a man in those situations, are those, you know, is that going to take over, and they're going to find themselves, you know, abusing and taking advantage of women or other individuals, and are they going to find themselves in that next court case? Right. I mean, I think the education to young boys and men is also equally, I think, important. And parents and friends and society should be worried about young men who think this is still okay to do.
Well, I do agree. And I have seen like a rise of like this in men that think that being super masculine is like cool. And it's primarily radicalizing young boys into thinking that they are somehow the dominant one over women. And we've seen cases like with the incels, for example, who believe that they have the right to go harm women because of that. And what's your reaction to that, I wanted to ask?
Well, I think there's definitely a backlash to, you know, women seeking justice, women seeking equality and equity. More recently in the political discourse, especially, you know, the rhetoric coming out from the U.S., from, you know, sort of the top leader of the country. It's also, you see it on social media platforms. You're also seeing, you know, individuals take up a lot of space, really, like you said, radicalizing young men to say, look, you know, women are taking over these, you know, that you need to gain your space as young men and boys. And I think that's rampant on social media. And I think young men and young boys that are trying to figure out who they are in the world. And so, you know, I think the social media platforms are doing massive damage. And I think, I would argue that many young boys are falling victims to that because they don't know where else to go. So that's hugely dangerous. And you know, I haven't mentioned this, but I think this is also part of the discourse, is that, you know, there is a huge porn culture that is present on social media, where young boys now have access to all kinds of violence against women and girls and non-binary folks, and even, frankly, violence against young boys as well. And I think that porn culture is creating all kinds of confusion to young people with regards to what healthy relationships should be, what healthy, you know, sexual relationships and should be. And so, you know, I don't want to underplay the impact social media has on giving, you know, creating norms for how young people to be in these situations. I think there's a huge damage being done, and definitely there's a rise to sort of that right wing and social media, you know, individuals who are taking that space up to give what I think, frankly, are very dangerous messages to young men.
Yeah, and survivors of high-profile cases often describe being re-traumatized through the court process and in general in this case. What specific procedural reforms could help minimize this harm?
Yeah, I mean, training to police around interviewing, first of all, right from the get-go, understanding how trauma impacts individuals. I think in terms of court proceedings, there are, you know, having individuals with support people with them. I think also, you know, having some procedures in place with regards to, you know, how the defense lawyers are able to treat individuals and the type of questioning and so on. I think, you know, I'm not a lawyer by profession, so I can't speak to that piece of it. But I think, you know, definitely making sure that, you know, an individual isn't giving testimonies for 6 hours straight or 4 hours straight. And, you know, how is how is a person that's going to be scrutinized? And you know, it's noteworthy to note that, you know, while in this particular case that we sort of saw in the public discourse, while EM was being cross-examined, you know, from what I understand, from what I know, and you know, I stand to be corrected, but what I understand is that the accused were literally on a different floor, just sitting there. They were not being held to account. They were not being asked those same types of questions. And that's how our system works, right? So I think, you know, reviewing and looking at what that looks like from, you know, from a legal lens, I think would be critical. And again, you know, to me, I think training, and really having the system understand that this type of crime is very nuanced, and you know, there are individuals within our society, advocates that work, that have a very strong knowledge and understanding of what survivors go through, and those individuals being allowed to support survivors during their proceedings, I think is critical.
Yeah, and I also, when I was reading this case, the judge who, like, dismissed all this, she was a woman who dismissed this entire case. And I'm just wondering, like, why would a female judge dismiss this if she kind of knows the situation that this woman went through?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we often will sort of think that, you know, because she's a woman, that, you know, she should know. I think with due respect to the judge, I think she did her job. I think that, you know, from a legal perspective, I mean, I think what was in front of her, what was presented to her, I think she deliberated on that. So I think as a judge, I think that's what she did. That's how the system is set up. That's how the system is created. And so I think, you know, I would want to put that to the side. Having said that, I think it's also important to understand that when it comes to whether it's a woman or a man issue, do women understand more what's happening, and do men understand less? I think we also need to look at, like, the intersectional lens of it, which is that, you know, class cuts across this as well. So, you know, if you have never experienced that form of violence, or you've not been victimized in that way, you're not going to have that level of understanding. And again, you know, it's not for me to say that this judge had that understanding or not, because I think she did her job the way the system is set up. But outside of this judge's experience, I think it's important to understand that, you know, even police, it doesn't mean just because you have a female police officer come and attend, all of a sudden you're going to get, you know, better experience. I think what's needed is systemic training, like everyone across the board in police, for example, all the Crown, all the judiciary across the board need to understand the nuances of these types of crime. And we can't count on the fact that just because there's going to be women there, they're going to have a better understanding, because I think the issue is the system. Mm-hmm. And the individual characters that work with inside that system need the training and need to have a strong understanding of the nuances of such crimes so that they can do their job when they are in those situations. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but I will say, like, one does not need to be a victim to understand that this is bad. I, thank God, am not one, but I completely will take the side of the victim, because I can't imagine going through this and just being re-traumatized again.
And I agree with you, but I think that, you know, if we only put the responsibility on women to have a personal experience and make sure that they deliver properly on those cases, the truth is we're going to have, you know, you have male judges that are going to deliberate, right? On the next mm-hmm. case, it's not going to be a female judge. So I think my point is that I think the system needs to be responsive, and then the characters inside the system need to be trained, right? So we're not just counting on the goodwill that you're going to get a female officer, you're going to get a female judge, therefore you'll get the better judgment, right? So again, I think that, you know, for sure, all of us individuals, you know, individual characters within our systems, you know, we need to come from a place where we have a strong understanding, like you said, like, of course you think that's wrong, therefore you're going to side with the victim. But having said that, you know, we need the men to be allies in this as well. We need all individuals to have a strong understanding that when someone is in a situation of power imbalance, that they may not be able to say no in that situation. And if they are saying no, they're being coerced into saying yes. And if they are coerced, and then if they want to report on that, they may not remember everything in such a neat way, in a clean and sort of way, because trauma impacts the brain, and you know, as the brain is healing from trauma, they will start to remember more. But in the immediate, if someone is being asked questions, they may find themselves they're shut down, or they don't have access to that memory right away. And the system needs to have an understanding of that, and the policies, procedures, and practices of our system then will follow. Does that make sense? So just kind of like moving it away from just the gender piece.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And I guess the last question would be, like, cases like this do often reveal deep-rooted cultural attitudes towards masculinity, sexuality, and entitlement, like I mentioned. How might these be addressed to prevent future assaults?
Well, I think education to men and boys. Our system so far, we often put in programs in place, teaching young girls and young individuals to take care of themselves, make sure you call somebody when you go in case you're in danger, or, protect yourself. And I want a world where we're not teaching people how to keep themselves safe. Mm-hmm. I want to live in a world where we're teaching people not to hurt others.
Yeah.
Right? And I think while we help create safety plans for survivors, while we teach young women, like, we should not be teaching young women to keep themselves safe. I think the focus needs to be on education about teaching young men and other individuals who potentially would harm, is to say, stop it. And we need to almost create an army of individuals in society. Like, everyone that sees that, and as you may know, we have at EVA BC, we have Be More Than a Bystander program, which is our partnership with the BC Lions. And we're going into schools and we're teaching young people to say, look, if you see somebody harming someone else, like, and we're really sort of encouraging boys to stand up and say something. And I think, nearly 50% of the population, which is boys and men, and predominantly that are potentially causing harm to, girls, women, and non-binary folks, they're the ones that I think the education needs to be focused on and say, look, stop causing the harm. If you see someone causing the harm, step up and be a leader. Mm-hmm. and tell them to stop, and support them to stop, and help them have a better understanding, because clearly girls and women saying this for centuries is not working. It's not preventing the actual work. All what women advocates and women are doing is we're just supporting survivors, and we just keep getting more survivors and more victims, where the focus has to be on stopping the violence by the men, and, mm-hmm. and men stepping up next to other men and saying, hey, that's not cool. We're better than that. And that's wrong. And I'm not going to participate. And you're my friend. And I want you not to be that guy. Right. And that's where I think the education and prevention work is really, really critical.
I think I will also be critical of these phrases and sayings like boys will be boys, or if he beats you, he loves you. I always hated these phrases because, like, how does he like you if he, like, beats you or pulls your hair? Like, I remember being told that as a kid, and now realizing that that's not a healthy thing to say to young girls.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think girls equally, we've been given so many messages if we go back even a couple of generations, right? Serving men. And I think part of, you know, the experience, a lot of, you know, the violence that's caused to young girls and women is predominantly because women and girls have been objectified within sort of this binary male-female situation. And so therefore, all the messages we got were about pleasing men and boys, right? Everything from picking up